Hi, this is Kim Mooney with Practically Dying and with the Conversation Project. We are really lucky this morning. We are bringing Katie Butler here on April 18th, and she wrote a book called Knocking on Heaven's Door that is an incredible story about her parents' journey through their end of life. Katie was a science writer and an investigative reporter. When she embarked on what has become a common rite of passage, seeing her aging parents through the end of their lives. The book that she wrote, Knocking on Heaven's Door, was a bestseller and was actually named Notable Book of the Year by the New York Times. In it, she unpacks what went wrong when her father, who was already devastated by a stroke and the beginning of dementias, was fitted with a pacemaker that overly prolonged the end of his life. And then her mother chose a radically different path in facing her own death because of what she'd seen in her family. Katie has since become a leading voice in the movement to reform how medicine deals with the end of life. And I have to tell you, one of the best part about her book, is the description of what it's like to work with medical technology, the history of it, why it works when you're going to get better, and why it doesn't work when you're not going to get better. We are bringing her to Boulder on April 18th. She'll be speaking at the 5th anniversary of the Conversation Project in Boulder. And she's talking about how to get those that you love onto a path that leads to a good end of life and how to avoid the pitfalls that her father and her family faced. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning. Thank you, Kim. I'm very much looking forward to coming to Boulder.
Great. I also want to say Constance Holden is with us. She is also with the Conversation Project. She was one of the co-founders. And both of us are working with the event that we're going to have Katie at. So let's just get started here. One of the most important things to me in that book was the whole history of the pacemaker, when it works, when it doesn't, and what it was like for you to decide when you were going to have it implanted and your inability to turn it off, because most people don't understand that there are even issues about this. Can you give us just sort of a background of what that
Sure.
whole thing is about?
Yes. In our family, the problem we faced or the dilemma was involved a pacemaker. But I want to make clear first that people are facing different versions of the same thing. It could be dialysis. It could be a defibrillator. It could be a feeding tube. It could be a heart surgery very, very late in someone's life. Essentially, World War II produced a explosion of medical innovation, and the pacemaker was just one part of this. The first pacemaker was actually designed using a metronome electronic from Popular Mechanics. And one of the first versions was actually put into the guy's body. It had been put into a shoe polish can and covered with, like medical-grade silicone. But essentially, this device times the heartbeat so that when your heartbeat gets slow, which happens quite naturally with age and also with certain medical conditions, the pacemaker essentially speeds it up with a little tiny electric shock that keeps the heart pacing. This is a wonderful thing for somebody with some kind of a heart condition, especially a younger, vigorous person. But it became, with the advent of Medicare, it became an extremely profitable medical device. And corporations rushed in and wanted to maximize their market. And so, as a result, pacemakers became a huge moneymaker and started getting put into people who, for whom it may not always be appropriate, in the sense of, does this really fit the emotional, spiritual, practical goals of the person involved? So is that enough, or should I go on?
Well, I think it would be great for people to know a little bit about what happens at end of life and why it was suggested that your father have one, and then what it was like to realize what was going on to try to turn it off. And Constance, by the way, is among many of her career pieces, it was a nurse, so she's seen this firsthand in the hospital too. But to the description and the understanding of what happens at end of life and how reluctant the medical profession is to stop doing this as well as many things is an integral part of the decision-making you had to go through and the challenges.
Yes, and I think what's interesting is that in our family, my parents, my dad was a professor and had a PhD. they had signed durable powers of attorney and living wills, advance directives. But it's almost like we're overprepared for something that only happens to a few people, which is ending up in the intensive care unit on a ventilator with a terrible brain damage and not wanting to be there. And we're unprepared for the much more subtle dilemmas that we're much more likely to face. So in my parents' case, my dad had this terrible stroke which disabled him and really destroyed his quality of life. He began to outlive his happiness, develop dementia, and start going blind. He needed a hernia surgery. He couldn't get a cardiac clearance from the cardiologist to have the surgery because he had a slow heartbeat. Now, the slow heartbeat was not creating any problems for him. He had no health problem related to the slow heartbeat. He was fine. But sometimes in medicine they call it treating the test, because he had the wrong score on the test. They wanted to put in a pacemaker to make sure nothing went wrong during the course of the surgery for the pacemaker. So he got the pacemaker and then got the hernia surgery. And what's so important, I think, in terms of the goals of the Conversation Project is how quickly that decision was made and how it was seen simply as a no-brainer, a way of creating safety. And there was no unpacking of the conversation, like, is this device going to over-prolong the end of his life when he has no reason to live? Mm-hmm. And this was a conversation. I was living in California. I was very dubious and concerned because of exactly this question. But at that point, I was so unsophisticated about the complexity of how medical technology has carried us away with it that I would have been afraid to raise that question because I felt I would have sounded like a very hard-hearted daughter. Mm. You know,
Katie, several people have commented on this to me, including some healthcare professionals, that in your book you seem quite angry with the physicians who would not agree to turn off your father's pacemaker at your request and your mother's. And yet, before your father had the pacemaker put in, you received, it seemed like, significant advice and support from your father's primary care physician, discouraging you from consenting or allowing the pacemaker to be put in. Can you talk about those dynamics?
Sure. And again, I think it's so important to unpack what happens here, because other families facing similar decisions may feel themselves sort of stampeded by time into a quick decision. And usually these decisions do not have to be made that quickly. And there's a whole movement called slow medicine now, which is about making these decisions more thoughtfully. So things kind of happened in the blink of an eye. It's true that my father's family care physician had pretty much recommended against a pacemaker a year or so earlier, before this crisis involving the hernia. But at the time of the sort of the hernia crisis and the pacemaker decision, he actually was not involved. And that's one of the things I point out in the book, is that Medicare would only have paid him $46 to have had what would have been a very prolonged family discussion about values, quality of life, exit plan. And so, in a sense, I hate to put it this way, but my mother was essentially stampeded into the decision in a 15-minute conversation with this cardiologist who did not know our family at all. So I think it's a little unfair to me to say that we disregarded advice and then were angry later. I think what's more important for the general public is that slow the process down and speak up. And if you do have a gut sense that maybe things are heading in the wrong direction, start asking questions then. I mean, what I understand now and didn't understand then is that there's no such thing as a minor procedure for someone in their 80s. Mm-hmm. And that's the time to say, let's slow the train down. Let's really unpack this. Let's talk about it as a family. And for someone like me, who's feeling dubious but also feeling guilty that she's even raising such questions to speak up anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because there has been a lot that's been done. We certainly have a lot more room for improvement. But one of the things that the Conversation Project has done is develop a very simple starter kit. And that is sometimes the first time that people actually talk about end of life. And the starter kit is designed to bring up some really preliminary questions, but it's getting people to talk in the same room. And as that develops, and it's not just one conversation, there is more ease, hopefully, and people do realize that their voice can be part of the conversation, and that can lead into better conversations with doctors. And opening up the topic, really, and I think a lot of what the Conversation Project has done, is empower people, not just to talk to their families, but to make decisions and to spread that out. And there's some beautiful information on how to talk to your doctor.
I think that's... it's wonderful. We have a conspiracy of silence going. And there's a conspiracy of silence between doctors and patients. And there's a conspiracy of silence within families.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the questions are, I think the question within the family that makes sense to me is, what are the kinds of deaths that you have seen or witnessed that you felt good about? And what are the ones that you fear for yourself?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also, what is quality of life for you? What makes your life worth living? And what are the circumstances in which, if you couldn't do certain things, or love and be loved, or communicate with your loved ones, or be in certain kinds of intractable pain, whatever it is for you, and that's very individual, I think, to articulate those things and then start talking about, and what kinds of medical... life-prolonging technologies would you want to refuse if that kind of quality of life was not really available to you? Because I think maybe 10% of us want to live no matter what, take the last possible drop of life.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people, that's fine. But the other 90% of us, I feel, are really in the process of developing a language to talk about what else we care about, mm-hmm, besides the maximum numbers of days or hours of our lives.
You know, another thing, one thing I want to tack on to that, too, is that people in our generation who are more comfortable talking about it really need to elicit from the older generation, which is not used to talking to doctors, not used to standing up for things, and they had different values. You know, they were tougher in a lot of ways and more private. And when we're asking these questions, it's often helpful to ask why. Tell me why you feel that way, why you think. One of the things we know at end of life is that a lot of people say that they don't want to be a burden to their family. And when you unpack that, that's, the family might not consider it a burden. So to really unpack what the particularly the older generation is sitting on that they may not be comfortable talking about.
And I do think, frankly, it cuts both ways, because I've also heard of people from the older generation who, when they try to raise these questions with their kids, are told, oh, mom, don't be morbid.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of a number of older people who have sent my book to their kids, you know, their kids in their 50s or 60s or 40s, and used that as a way to open up the discussion. So I don't think it's just... It's not only a one-way problem, and doctors will often tell you that, you know, there's a term in medicine, which I'm sure Constant knows, which is called moral distress, and that's the pain of doctors and nurses when they feel forced to, let's say, do CPR on someone whose ribs are going to break and who's probably not going to survive, because family members have not come to terms with the reality that death is approaching. And so... it cuts both ways, and it really just depends, I think, on the particular family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our family, we thought we were very open and blunt about all of these things. And yet, because of the power of these technologies and the subtleties of some of these decisions, we weren't as well prepared as we thought.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, that, I think, is a segue into... the whole idea of healthcare professionals helping people visit what the values are about that their loved one has. So it sounds like your father had, in fact, documented some of his wishes. It does sound like you actually talked about them, but it doesn't sound like the healthcare professionals helped you revisit those documents that he had and what he might have written in there. He said, I would prefer not to have life-extending treatments, you might have thought about that pacemaker in another way in a meeting with the healthcare professionals.
Yes, and when this happened, it was before Medicare paid anything for advanced directive conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of it. And the advanced directive, like many people's advanced directive, only dealt with the last 6 months of life or being in a coma.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't say anything about dementia. Mm-hmm. It didn't say anything about tiny little devices that are internalized, like a pacemaker. Again, this is why I think the Conversation Project is so important, because there's a lot of unpacking to do. And I think where the medical professionals let us down, and this is really widely documented, is that we need to start introducing the possibility of the end of life about 5 years before
mm-hmm.
we think people are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
We need to start saying, I'm approaching the end of my life. I'm 85. I don't know, matter how healthy I am, I'm still approaching the end of my life. And if I have, mm-hmm. you know, diabetes and heart disease, then it's even more likely.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we can't time it perfectly and doctors can't tell us very specifically when we're going to die, simply getting used to the idea that we're approaching the end of our lives is, I think, very, very valuable
mm-hmm.
because it's crazy to expect a family member who shows up at the ICU with a parent or loved one who's got a stage 4 cancer, and it's news to them this person is close to death.
Yeah.
It's really unfair mm-hmm. to emergency room doctors, to ICU doctors, and to families to expect them in the heat of the moment among a bunch of strangers and a lot of chaos mm-hmm. to suddenly, you know, become enlightened and say, okay, I totally accept that my parent is dying and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to put them through terrible suffering.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. So I just want to remind people, this is Kim Mooney with Practically Dying and the Conversation Project. And Constance Holden is here with me, who is a co-founder of the Conversation Project. She's been actively involved in the community in many aspects of end-of-life care. So a real asset for us. And we are on KGNU Community Radio, 88.5 FM, an incredible community resource, which, by the way, is celebrating its 40th year anniversary in the community right now. I have one more question really quickly, because we're going to move on here. And that is, your mother refused interventions for her heart disease. So the shift in the family happened. I'm sure there was a process that she went with. You don't all of a sudden decide that you're, you know, going to change, and you don't go through your own process for your own life or what you've seen historically medically. Over all of that time, you were dealing with helping your mother. You were dealing with the loss of your parents, the grief of watching a dementia decline, facing the medical system, being a long-distance caregiver, trying to resolve relationships. They were, you know, that was a lot. So can
yeah.
you just ask,
yeah.
how did it change you? Who have you become today that you wouldn't have been? And then I want to go back and ask some non-related questions.
Okay. Yes, and I do want to say that I think it is very possible to shape the end of your life a lot better if you are informed
mm-hmm.
and you're willing to take on the spiritual task of facing the reality of the end of life. And so the only reason I speak about this at all is because I think that as people get more educated and empowered, they have a much, much better chance of forging a path to the end of life that's really meaningful, even joyful sometimes,
mm-hmm.
And free of unnecessary suffering,
mm-hmm.
especially medically induced suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So I really want to empower people. That's my whole purpose for talking about this. So what happened with my mom is that for 6.5 years, she was a 100-hour-a-week caregiver for my dad. She saw the devastation of a slow decline and of stroke damage. When she was faced with the possibility of open heart surgery, she really needed it. I mean, her valves were leaky. She, you know, was breathless and in having chest pain at night. she became someone whose first question to the surgeon was, I'm here to ask questions. She was no longer someone who would just defer to a medical recommendation. And that had both advantages and disadvantages. So essentially, she became absolutely terrified of the prospect of becoming debilitated and dependent on others, and especially of suffering a stroke. And having a stroke was a realistic risk of open-heart surgery at the age of 83, or 84, actually, by the time she actually was contemplating it. I later found research that suggested that someone of her age and condition had a 40% chance of either not surviving the surgery or ending up in a nursing home after it. And what happened was that she contemplated it. She was pretty much told to do it by a cardiologist who didn't even ask her if she had any questions. She and I went to Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, which was a leader in open-heart surgery among the very old. And she asked all these questions. And when she was told that they would not respect her do not resuscitate order if she had surgery, she just simply made a decision not to do it. And the result was that she knew she was facing her death, and she had 5 months to clean up her house, throw things out, to apologize to me about something quite minor. We both got a chance to say goodbye to each other in a meaningful way. She got a chance to let me know how much she loved my partner, Brian, who's now my husband, and to tell me to cherish him. She got to have a very meaningful death. Now, some people might think she died too soon because of that decision, but I really think it was right for her.
Mm-hmm.
I was very ambivalent. I both wanted to make sure she had the research and she understood the risks and that she made her own decision. But I also didn't want to lose my mother, who was also my friend.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard. It was hard to back her up at certain points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Katie, I'm sitting here in this studio with going thumbs up to your mother. she, however, had the really good fortune of having her mental faculties about her, her
yes.
ability, as we call it in the business, this decisional capacity.
Right.
Your father wasn't so fortunate because of his stroke and his dementia. There's a movement afoot to develop what are called dementia directives, documents that people can fill out when they are well, before they develop dementia, or when they're in the very early stages of dementia. Can you comment on those and what you know about them and the place and the role that they might occupy?
Yeah, I think they're very valuable. I personally created my own dementia letter, which is attached to my advance directive and that I've sent to my medical decision makers so that they know very explicitly what I want. And mine says it's very, very explicit because I am a moral person now and I do care about my burden on my caregivers. And when I become demented, I might seem quite happy, but I will lose the moral capacity to care about the effect of what's going on others. And so I want to make my decisions very explicit now. And mine includes, you know, do not give me antibiotics. Do not transport me from the place that has become my home. It also says, if I have to be institutionalized, please put me in a place where there's an art studio and some access to the outside. So mine is pretty simple and very explicit and hardline.
Mm-hmm.
My only concern about the ones that are being developed is that they've got too many checkboxes, and to me they frankly look a bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the elements that the one from New York now has, which I think is very important and somewhat challenging, is if do not hand feed me, mm-hmm. even if I open my mouth, if I'm not explicitly sort of asking for food. And again, this may be really the most kind and wise approach. But it's not going to be for everybody.
Right.
And again, I mean, that's the importance of the whole conversation we're having is you need to think through what works for you. And I do think some form of dementia directive is really important because your decisions are going to be made by family members, and often family members will subject you to something that they would not want for themselves, out of guilt, out of a lack of clarity of your values. It's a terrible position to be in, to be the person who says, no feeding tube, and I hate to say it, but sometimes doctors in the past have said things like, nobody starves to death on my watch, or, you know, outrageous pressure is put on people to say yes. I know one woman who was asked 5 times within 24 hours whether she understood that if her father didn't get a feeding tube, he might develop pneumonia, aspirate something, develop pneumonia, and die. And that's just a really unfair pressure to put on someone. Now, that particular father had, in fact, signed the complex advance directive called a POLST and had said to his daughter very clearly before he got demented, hell no, no feeding tube for me. Mm-hmm. So she had the internal backup to stand up for him in that situation.
I think there are three things really quickly that are really affecting this. One is that food is probably the most challenging thing to talk about because we're so attached to feeding people. It's very different than a piece of medical technology. And also, dementia is the most feared future in this country. And we know that over 50% of the people in this country will have some problem, whether it's dementia or not, with decisional capacity at the end of life. So a huge number of us are looking at that kind of vulnerability. You know, as we move along in this process, I think that we'll see more challenging pieces. We'll see things come up, and hopefully we'll see much more resolution for those who cannot make decisions at the end of life. We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to talk about your new book coming out.
Thank you. Yes, I felt in some ways that my first book, the last two chapters of my first book, is a wonderful little how-to guide, but I really felt like the first book really explored the problem and the commercial drivers that have helped force end-of-life technology into this terrible role. And my new book is really about solutions, and it's called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. And it really looks at about 7 life stages that precede active dying and how to address medical care through all of those stages, because they really set the stage for having a good end of life. So there's a stage I call the threshold, which is where you're still in early, healthy, resilient old age, when you really need to emphasize lifestyle changes and diet and exercise. And then as you start to progress into various forms of decline or facing a terminal diagnosis, how to become more empowered and ask the right questions about your medical care so that you don't end up on this pathway of overtreatment, highly technological, fixing approaches toward your life and your situation, and instead get on pathways that will emphasize quality of life, emphasize maintaining and improving your function, and making sure that you have medical allies in place that can help you relieve your suffering and attend your dying when those things become on your horizon. So my hope is that it's going to inspire people to have collaborative relationships with the right kinds of medical care. As we all will develop, we will all develop unfixable conditions. And once we develop unfixable conditions, we need geriatrics doctors, we need palliative care doctors, we eventually need hospice, we need a lot of other unsung heroes like occupational therapists who will do miracles for you. But a lot of us, we kind of overlook them or don't even know what they can do for us.
Right.
And so that's the purpose of the book.
Well, so I want to thank you for being with us this morning. I would recommend people read both books because I think the first one is a really good primer for what you're talking about. And it is that personal story. and the new book coming up. We're really glad to have had you on the radio. I consider you a cultural influencer in end-of-life care.
Thank you.
And I want to remind everybody that we are bringing her, the Conversation Project is bringing here on April 18th to Boulder. You can get a lot of information about that on the Conversation Project in Boulder.org website. It is both National Healthcare Decisions Week, and it is also the 5th anniversary of the Conversation Project in Boulder.
Katie, I'm so looking forward to meeting you in person and especially interested in hearing about the insights that I know that are going to be revealed in your new book. See you on the 18th of April.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.